KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Myra. Coming up on Forum, independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader and his new running mate, San Francisco's Matt Gonzalez, a former Board of Supervisors president and mayoral candidate back in 2003. They'll join us from Washington, D.C. at the start of their joint campaign. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Myra, sitting in for Michael Krasny. He'll be back on Monday. Independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader has named his running mate San Francisco's own Matt Gonzalez, former Board of Supervisors president and mayoral candidate. Both join us today from WAMU in Washington, D.C. to talk about their campaign. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Rachel.
Ralph, what do you hope to accomplish with this run that you haven't accomplished running before this?
Many things. One is to put before the American people all the taboo agendas that the two parties don't talk about. Notice neither Obama, Clinton, or McCain are talking about single-payer health insurance for all Americans, which is supported by a majority of people in the United States. And in a forthcoming poll, 59% of the doctors. The military budget is off discussion. Imagine the bloated, wasteful military budget that the press has exposed again and again, Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, etc., off the table. The Middle East, issues of the Israeli-Palestine conflict and the Iraq War, they really don't have a withdrawal strategy from the Iraq War. Neither of the candidates are opposed to nuclear power. None of them are asking for an aggressive crackdown on the trillions of dollars that the corporate crime wave has taken from or drained from pensions and workers and investors from Enron to Wall Street. Of course, they'll never talk about impeachment of the most impeachable president in American history. They won't talk about electoral reform, opening up the presidential debates, repealing the anti-union Taft-Hartley law, and shifting taxes from things we like human labor and food and appliances, clothing, sales taxes, to things we like the least, like security speculation, pollution, the old saying, you know, first tax what we burn, not what we earn. First tax what we bet, not what we net. That needs a big debate.
If your main aim is to put these issues under a national spotlight, isn't there a more effective way to do it than essentially piggybacking on the presidential race?
Piggybacking? Two corrupt parties who've spoiled our country, our government, the Republicans being the worst, the Democrats being bad enough, the Democrats who define themselves down by telling us, do you know how bad the Republicans are, instead of defining itself upward, dialing for the same corporate dollars. And, you know, Washington is in a mess. 3 out of 4 Americans polled believe the country's going in the wrong direction. 61% in the Gallup polls say both parties are failing. And you say piggyback? Our government has shut the people of this country out from having the opportunity, the chance to improve our country. And when Washington shuts us down, we're going after those two political parties, and we're going to give the American people broader frameworks, broader opportunities, broader visions, broader horizons, and concrete ways to improve their daily life.
A lot of rank-and-file Democrats, not just in polls, people I've talked to on the street, feel the Bush administration has proven there's really a big difference between Republicans and Democrats. You're still going to argue that they're more or less the same?
Rachel, let me jump in here. I just want to remind everybody that Bush wouldn't have been able to do most of the things that he's done to this country during his presidency if it hadn't have been with the help of the Democrats. Let's just be candid about that. They've voted for his war appropriations repeatedly.
They've We appear to have lost the connection. Let me give out the number because we want you guys to join this discussion. Call in at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. Hopefully we'll have that connection restored in a moment. They're talking to us from WAMU in Washington, D.C., and it seems we've got you guys back. Matt Gonzalez, you were talking to us just a moment ago.
Right. I was trying to emphasize, Rachel, that, you know, we can lay all the blame on George Bush, or we can be realistic about this and acknowledge that the Democratic Party supported his war, voted appropriations for the war, continued to do that, supported the Patriot Act, supported NAFTA, supported WTO, supported all of these things. Even in San Francisco, I can recall the excitement that there was when Nancy Pelosi was going to take back Congress and they were going to stop the war. And Cindy Sheehan threw her hands up and gave up with these folks. I mean, it's just so apparent that they're always going to come at us with the same tired rhetoric. And, you know, what we're trying to do fundamentally is consistent with democratic principles. We're basically saying, look, we have different views, and we ought to have an opportunity to enter a political contest and express them. Now, if there's a problem that voting for Nader Gonzalez presents some kind of problem because of how elections are done, well, then let's fix that. Let's address that. But the Democrats who lay the blame on Ralph for what happened in 2000 have done nothing since 2000 to correct that, and they never point out that they've been the beneficiaries of the same thing that they complain about, which is, you know, the way Bill Clinton won because Ross Perot entered the contest. And so in the face of this repeating reality where we can either choose not to run and apparently ever run because it's not going to be fixed in 4 years and it's not going to be fixed 4 years after that, if losing the presidency in 2000 has not fixed the problem, then we have no choice but to run, and then we get attacked because, you know, because we're running. And even though we're talking substantive issues, somehow there's a belief that individuals that are voting for us are somehow, there's an entitlement to that support. I invite the Democratic candidates to go out and earn the votes that are that would come to us.
You know, I think what Matt is also saying is that Gore won the popular vote in 2000. The Electoral College took it away from him. The shenanigans of the Bush team in Florida took it away from him. So the Democrats should be talking about getting rid of the Electoral College, where you can come in second in America and still become president. And they should have gone for electoral reform, which might have prevented some of the problems in 2004 in Ohio. So they should look in the mirror, stop scapegoating, stop whining, look in the mirror, and remember their best traditions in past years. Right now, people are worried about $4 gallon gas prices, which some stations, I'm told this morning, are charging in California. They're worried about staggering drug prices for their medicine. They're worried about keeping their home. They're worried about losing their job to corporations that are shipping industries to a communist dictatorship known as China. And what are these Democrats doing? They're avoiding these issues. And we've got to, as voters, never mind candidates, we've got to really shake up the system and tell these two parties, if they don't stop representing big business, that we're going to ship them out.
Okay, but you're talking to the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Green Party country. Matt Gonzalez is a Green Party candidate. If even the Bay Guardian comes out against this campaign, if you can't convince the San Francisco Bay Area, isn't it time for a strategic reassessment?
But Rachel, why are you making the assumption that a journalist at the Bay Guardian is the end of the discussion? That journalist, I think, needs a basic civics lesson and has to just confront the reality that there's nothing wrong with confronting the other candidates on their record. I want to say something about Senator Obama and his position on the war, because many people somehow are buying into some notion that he is supporting a withdrawal from Iraq. And I just want to tell you that that's not what he has said. He was asked explicitly whether or not he could commit to getting soldiers out by January 2013. He would not commit that in a public debate when he was asked by Tim Russert. Since that time, with anti-war sentiment at its peak, he has said that he's going to get combat troops out of Iraq within a year of his presidency. But at the same time he says that, he's been saying things like he's going to leave enough soldiers there to continue counterterrorism efforts and so that we can strike at al-Qaeda. And it's a Democratic think tank that has concluded that he's basically talking about a continued occupation that would require 60,000 soldiers. That's what Bill Richardson said during his campaign, and that's what appears to be Senator Obama's position. Those who want to believe that he's fighting to get, you know, this campaign to get us out of the war need to listen carefully. And I'll also emphasize he's also calling for an expansion of the military by 100,000 soldiers, and he's talking about redeploying soldiers into Afghanistan, presumably that he takes out of Iraq. So this is very significant that there be other voices that really try to commit the candidates to the right place.
And our website, yeah, votenator.org, will provide a continuing assessment along the lines of what Matt has just described of the major party candidates, a progressive assessment without the malarkey that often infects these campaigns. We have to raise our standards of expectation for politics and political representatives. Otherwise, they'll drag us down into the corporate abyss.
Well, I should mention that earlier when I was talking about the Bay Guardian, that was not an official endorsement. That was an opinion on the blog by the editor. Let's go to some calls now. We've got Larry in San Anselmo basically wanting to make a comment.
Larry? Yeah, my comment is that I think that these two people, again, are deluding themselves into thinking there's no choice. Barack Obama is the most exciting presidential candidate since Bobby Kennedy in 1968. This man does represent choice. And what's more important is I can't believe Ralph Nader is standing up here opposing a liberal Democrat and potentially putting him at risk again because he's probably the most arrogant man in America. It's disgusting.
All right. Well, Larry, let's let Ralph get back at that. Well,
I think Larry, you should have heard the list that I just gave of issues that you may be concerned about, but not Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, or McCain. Single-payer health insurance, going after that military budget, releasing tax dollars to rebuild the infrastructure in the Bay Area and around the country. Good jobs can't be exported to China. Opposing nuclear power, that's what we do. Cracking down on corporate crime that's ripping you off every day, credit cards and all the things that people are complaining about, where their money is being controlled by these banks and credit card companies. I mean, just focus on the issues. I'll grant you, Barack Obama has probably the most brilliant tactician. He's got the most exciting speech a Democrat has put forward in many years. But reform, my friend, comes from you and the American people. It isn't just 1% inspiration. It's got to be 99% perspiration.
Rachel, let me try to address the caller this way. I would say, look, if you want to vote for another candidate because you believe in them, then you should. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what we advocate. But I think it's important that you come to terms with the fact that this idea of a spoiling is built into the system, and the parties that benefit from the spoiling don't want to fix the system. This is an American tradition. Of the last 100 years, the last 24 presidential races, we've had eight of them, a full third of them, decided with the winner getting less than a majority. And while the Democrats always complain about Nader in 2000, they don't talk about Clinton's two terms because of Ross Perot. They don't talk about Kennedy defeating Nixon by 0.2% of the vote. There was an independent candidate that had 0.4 in that contest. They don't talk about the two terms Woodrow Wilson won with less than 50% because the Republican Party split. And, you know, there's such a long history of this. You start to understand that it's not an accident that the problem hasn't been repaired. You know, in San Francisco, I fought for election reform. I even, at my own expense, went to talk to progressive members of Congress after I left the Board of Supervisors at the invitation of Lynn Woolsey. And I said to them, let's not have to go through this every 4 years. Let's not repeat this exercise, because there's got to be a way that we can have a majority outcome. And if they don't commit to making these changes, what are we to do? Never step forward? Never address the differences that we have on these major trade agreements, on these major issues, everything from class action reform to the North American Free Trade Agreement to credit card interest rates to limiting economic or non-economic damages in tort cases, regulating the nuclear industry, energy policy, death penalty.
But there's so many issues. I mean, third-party candidates often and historically have managed to push at least some of the sort of big-ticket items onto the candidate onto the platform of the front runner and you know, make it happen. I'm thinking of the New Deal in particular. But if you're getting diminishing returns at the box office, can't you at the box office that is the voting booth, can't you argue that this is just not accomplishing what you wanted to accomplish?
I invite you to come to Washington, Rachel, on your favorite cause that is not acceptable to corporations and see if you can even get through the door, whether you can get a hearing, whether you can even meet with a member of Congress unless you have a checkbook next to you, whether you can get the Food and Drug Administration or the Occupational Safety and Disease Agency to even respond to your petition. Sometimes you can't even get through to them on the phone. We've lost our government. Washington, D.C. is corporate occupied territory. Anybody who argues like Larry, how dare you run, is a political bigot. Saying to people that they cannot express their First Amendment rights and run for office is equivalent to the people over our history who have said to people, do not print that, do not speak that, and do not vote if you're the wrong color. Believe in freedom, Larry, choice, diversity, inside the electoral arena. Otherwise, you'll see your country dragged down.
Well, speaking of history...
Rachel, let me just jump in for a moment, because there seems to be something sort of contradictory about, on the one hand, saying, well, you know, you're not getting any votes, so why do it? You know, suggesting that you're not relevant or that you're not going to accomplish anything. Well, then how could candidates who aren't going to get any support cost the election? And if we can have that impact, well, then... Wouldn't the major parties, wouldn't the Democratic Party have committed themselves to a reform to fix this problem? Their answer is to wait every 4 years to the eve of the election to start telling everybody they can't vote for candidates they believe in. And I think Barack Obama got it right when Ralph announced his candidacy, and he said, hey, it's a democracy. People have a right to run, you know?
Well, my question really goes more to the question of strategic efficacy, but let me give up the floor and give it to David in Philadelphia.
I'm just calling in to say that I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 because I loved his politics and I thought he was the best candidate, and I will continue to do that, and I support him 100%. And I think the fact that people think that, you know, it's all about his ego and things like that, I mean, it's patriotism. He's a patriot. He stands for what people in America really believe, and I just applaud him every step of the way. I think that there's to call him anything but a patriot is to just forego democracy 100%.
Well, you know, I'm gratified by your comment, and it made me remember the 19th century when a few voters decided to abandon the Whigs and the Democrats and vote for the anti-slavery Liberty Party. Aren't we glad they did that? Or the few voters who abandoned the Whigs and the Democrats and voted for the Women's Suffrage Right to Vote Party, or the later on the Labor Party, the Farmer Populist Party. None of them ever won an election, Rachel. Some of them didn't even get close, but they pushed those social justice missions up to a higher level of visibility and got one or both of the major parties eventually to adopt them. In a rigged two-party elected dictatorship, that's about the best that can be expected until we change the whole system through fundamental corporate, fundamental electoral reform, from public financing of public elections all the way to getting rid of these ballot access obstructions that only serve to entrench further the two-party hegemony.
Rachel, I want to address the efficacy issue that you raise, because I think it does require a variety in terms of strategy. And so for me, that's included actual election reform to show that you can implement voting systems that are used in other countries like Ireland and England to get a majority outcome regardless of how many candidates are in the field. It's what we have in San Francisco with instant runoff voting. It means writing opinion editorials, meeting with members of Congress, policymakers who can implement the change. It means doing many things, not just running for president and vice president of the United States, but running for these offices also makes it very clear that we're not going to go away and allow the current system to stay in place. And the mere fact that you've invited both of us on your show today to talk about these issues is an example of why, if you're talking efficacy, this is part of how we accomplish what we need to accomplish, which is we want a better democracy. We want outcomes decided by a majority rather than the way it is right now with these plurality victories.
Well, along those lines, Laurie in Davis wants to put this question to Ralph, and I'd love to put it to Matt as well. Why not run for Congress?
It's very simple. When you want to reach the entire country about the lack of responsiveness of the two parties, about how they have allowed these giant multinational corporations to hijack our government, you tend to reach more people. When you run for president and you want to highlight all the ways at the state level that these ballot access laws are obstructing more voice, more choice by keeping third-party independent candidates off the ballot. That's the basic reason, is to try to arouse the American people all over the country. We're running a 50-state campaign, as will be made very clear on our website, votenator.org, in order to do that.
And you know, Rachel, I would answer that by saying, look, Cindy Sheehan is running against Pelosi, and I'm supporting her, and I'm one of the few elected or former elected officials anywhere in the region that came out to support her at her kickoff. When you talk about going after Democrats who vote badly, you know, Ned Lamont tried to defeat, Ralph's home state, tried to defeat Lieberman, and what did we get there? We had Clinton and Obama supporting Lieberman, somebody who was called essentially, one of the hawks, big supporter of Bush. Alexander Coburn laid it out very clearly. He called him, Bush's closest Democratic ally on the Iraq War. So, you know, we do include that as part of the strategy.
Matt, what have you been up to in between this and your time running for mayor?
Well, you know, after the mayor's race, I continued to serve on the board for an entire another year. And it was at that time that I was trying to decide what I wanted to do, whether or not I wanted to stay in office. And I wasn't ready to commit to four more years. I thought two more years would have been the right amount of time. And I felt pretty confident that the seat could be retained by a Green, in this case Ross Mercurimi, and he was able to win the seat, and I've appreciated some of his legislative efforts. I started a progressive law practice and have been handling a variety of different types of lawsuits, including fighting for greater diversity in grand juries, fighting on behalf of folks who have been, civil rights abuses, free speech cases, police brutality cases, that sort of thing.
And Ralph Nader?
The usual problems: consumer, environmental, government accountability, freedom of information, dealing with these trade agreements, erosions on workers around the world, and going after corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, for starters.
Well, let me put the call out to the public again. You can join this discussion by calling 866-733-6786 or by emailing forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro, here with Ralph Nader and Matt Gonzalez, running for President of the United States in 2008. I should ask you, gentlemen, why run as an independent with a Green? How does that work logistically?
Well, Rachel, obviously I'm in the Green Party. Ralph has been an independent, I believe, all of his life. And we gave great consideration to this. And Ralph obviously has a very long history with the Green Party. A lot of that is a very positive history. But we were also very mindful that, you know, there are candidates in that contest. Cynthia McKinney, I expect, is going to win that nomination. I think Ralph, both of us like her very much. We admire a lot of the good work that she's done. And I think that it helps highlight, if she runs on the Green ticket and we run as independents where we can, it's going to highlight that this isn't an issue about just Ralph Nader, that if Ralph Nader didn't run, you're always going to have other people out there every 4 years that are trying to open up this system to greater choices. And so for that reason, we've decided to run as independents. And in some states, we will try to get ballot lines of parties that exist who are interested in having us on those ballot lines. And the way ballot access laws work, unfortunately, in some states, it's actually you need less votes or less signatures, rather, to get on the ballot if you're a member of a party than if you run independent. So we may even be forming parties in certain states to achieve that.
That's a lot to take care of in less than a year.
Well, you know, it's also one of the issues that we want to raise during the campaign. There really should be national standards on ballot access, and there ought to be some public policy discussion about what those standards ought to be. You know, in some states, they make it incredibly difficult to get on the ballot, and of course, we would take the position it's a very anti-democratic system.
Well, with that, let's move on to Michael in Oakland.
Hi, thanks very much. I appreciate the chance to talk to any candidate running for any office. You know, there are those of us on the progressive side who completely agree that the Democrats and the Republicans are Tweedledum and Tweedledee when it comes to corporate power and the military-industrial complex. But I want you, and particularly Matt, you gave me the segue by talking about your progressive law practice, to focus in solely on the federal judiciary, the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts, and tell me whether you think they are Tweedledum and Tweedledee, that is to say whether there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans in appointing federal judges, because some of us think that is the only thing, that independent judiciary, that's keeping us from out-and-out fascism.
Matt?
I think it's a good point. You know, when I joined the Green Party and I published an editorial about it, I made it clear in that editorial that I did not think the two parties were identical. The problem that gets presented is, are there sufficient differences for us to essentially lay down our values every 4 years and just accept these two choices? And to that point, I would say no. Concerning the federal judiciary, I think it is incredibly important, but you know, even when John Kerry was running for president 4 years ago, he was saying that he would appoint anti-abortion, anti-choice judges, but that he would make sure that they didn't want to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I just remember shaking my head thinking, oh, my God, here we got a Democratic president, you know, guy who's running for president, and he still is talking like this. I think social movements keep the principles and the rules that we want in place from being jeopardized. And I think a good case in point are the court decisions related to sodomy. You know, a more liberal bench back when many of the giants like Marshall and Brennan were on the court ruled against the in favor of upholding statutes related to, you know, anti-sodomy laws. It was a more conservative court with more Republicans on it that actually ruled in that Texas case more favorably. And to my mind, it's not because Republican judges are better on the issue. It's that the force of history and the social realities of what had taken place in the two decades, or I don't know how many years it was, 15 years in between those decisions, was so powerful that even a Republican judiciary couldn't turn their back on it.
The Democratic Party is reducing its opposition to Republican judicial nominees. I remember Nixon put forward Supreme Court nominees Carswell. The Democrats in the Senate turned him down. He then put up Haynesworth. The Democrats in the Senate turned him down until he put up Blackmun. But look what's happened since. 98-0 was the Senate vote for Scalia. I couldn't even get one senator when I was lobbying up there, including Al Gore, to vote against Scalia. The vote on Justice Thomas was 52-48, with 11 Democrats moving across the aisle to support Thomas. And, of course, they could have defeated or blocked Alito and Roberts. You know, when you have a large majority party in the Senate with the filibuster and other rules, you could keep turning them down until the Republican president comes up with someone acceptable like Souter or Blackmun. So even in that area, the Democrats are not what they once were.
Well, with that, let's go to Herb in San Francisco.
Herb. Hello. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I want to say I'm really angry at Ralph Nader because the last several elections have been close enough that had this crucial vote swung in either way, the Democrats could have gotten in. And before moving to San Francisco, I lived in Nebraska for a good number of years, and I know there are enough people out there that will never vote for a black, they'll never vote for a woman, and it's like, okay, let's spread this vote around, and that's not going to work, because we could throw it back into the hands of the Republicans immediately by throwing too many candidates in.
Herb, let's throw that to Mr. Nader.
What would Herb have us do? Give me your recommendation.
Oh, sorry. I presumed I, you were going
to Okay, you see, yeah. What would Herb have us do is don't run. So the country is in the control of two parties, which is never mentioned in our Constitution or in our laws. You see, once you go down the path of censoring, of telling people not to run, what's next? Not to act? Don't print that? Don't put that play on because it might embarrass somebody? Let me put it in another way. Gore won the election in the popular vote. Get rid of the Electoral College. Gore won the election in Florida. Get rid of the crooked techniques that Republicans have used in Florida and Ohio. In other words, stop scapegoating the Greens or other small parties. I don't hear people calling and saying they were opposed to Perot running, you know, or to Buchanan running, or to the Libertarian running. It's only on the progressive side that they want to censor and exclude and repress. You must believe in democracy, and that means you give people a chance to be heard whether or not you agree with them. That's Civics 101, and that's exactly what Mayor Bloomberg said the other day in New York when asked about our candidacy. He says they have every right to run, all power to them. It doesn't matter whether they are members of the major parties or not. I, Mayor Bloomberg, learned this lesson in junior high school civics.
But, Mr. Nader, let me put this question to you. I mean, you're a widely respected consumer advocate by people on the left and the right, and you've created a number of incredibly effective organizations that push for things like greater consumer protections and the Freedom of Information Act comes to mind as a journalist. Might it be more effective for something like electoral reform to create an organization like one of the ones you've already created?
We have, and others have. You can't get anything done in Washington. You got to understand that. If we could get something done in Washington, we would be citizen advocates as we have been for years. The doors have closed. The windows have closed. You understand that Thomas Jefferson, when he said, when you lose your government, you got to have a revolution. And I think we need a Jeffersonian revolution. You got to go into the electoral arena. You know, what's important? Let me put it in a very personal way, Rachel. People listening to this program, we are being blocked on 30 major issues, from environment to trade, from war and peace, from consumer to worker rights, etc. Now, let's say someone's listening here and believes that the two parties are against the state of Israel. Let's say people are listening and they believe that the two parties are against gay, lesbian rights. Let's say they're sitting, listening to this program, and they say, these two parties are against women's rights. Tell me how long it would take before any one of those cause supporters would move to start a third party.
Rachel, I want to jump in here, too, because, you know, I understand where the caller is coming from, but I think the caller may not really be aware the extent to which we really have tried to get this election reform issue on the table. Kevin Zeese, a good friend of both of ours, ran for the United States Senate in Maryland against two pro-war candidates. And we went to the state legislature there. There was a bill that was put together primarily by green activists who were saying, look, this guy's going to run. You guys can pass a law that implements majority voting so that there can't be a spoiling of this contest. And you know what? The Democrats that controlled the committee and that controlled the entire legislature wouldn't pass the measure out of committee. Zeese ultimately ran. He didn't spoil that contest. But, you know, we just all shook our heads trying to understand, why aren't the Democrats helping us institute a reform that would allow them to get the second votes that they claim that they would get, you know, from voters who would be voting for these alternative and third party candidates?
I should ask for Diane in Berkeley. She writes in via email to say the presidential campaign started nearly a year ago with more than a dozen candidates, some of whom espoused the positions that you gentlemen espouse. Why didn't Ralph Nader choose to run from the start rather than, as she puts it, jumping in at the 10-yard line?
Well, first of all, I don't believe in long campaigns. I think American people don't like it either. Second, it takes preparatory time. We had an exploratory period to test whether we are going to get enough volunteers, enough pro bono lawyers to challenge all the lawsuits that the Democrats are going to bring to try to get us off the ballot. They filed 24 of them in 2004 in a mere 12-week period against us to drain us, distract our resources. And third, whether we could raise enough money. You know, we're not taking commercial money. We're not taking political action committee money. And as our website makes very clear, we are very frugal, and we welcome individual contributions. So it took a while to get the phrases, testing the waters, and we've decided that there is a substantial response and that there are more than a few voters who want a choice of candidates. 60% of the voters want a viable third party. It doesn't mean they're going to vote for a viable third party, but their instinct is that they want something other than Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola.
Let's go to the phones again. Paul in San Jose, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Mr. Nader, but first a comment. Three cheers for running. Great courage. The conclusion I've come to is it's time for a second American Revolution, and we were hoping that Ron Paul was going to be the one who was going to ignite the citizens to start overturning the systemic corruption. So thank you very much for doing this, and I hope I can help out. The question is, as president, would you commit yourself to immediately overturning the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act?
No, of course. Great. Answer, yes. I opposed the Patriot Act from the get-go, and I believe the civilian courts with their due process protections are absolutely essential here for the kind of cases that Bush would like to bring in Guantanamo that violate a lot of the procedural due process. And by the way, we've worked with military lawyers who have shown up the civilian lawyers in the Justice Department under Ashcroft toward that end.
Rachel, I wanted to interject here and just say that I hope that in the event that you have, and I don't know if you have or haven't, but if you have any of the presidential candidates, other candidates running, I hope that you will ask them questions related to their own histories on working on election reform. It just seems to me that it's odd to give those candidates free rein. A lot of the press has done this to complain about the election in 2000, even though there's no record of any effort by any of these candidates to reform how we do elections. So it seems to me that they should not have any kind of standing to complain about other candidates running.
This is a Democratic Party that can't defend the country against the worst Republican Party in history. The Democrats, it can be argued, won in Florida. They won the election in 2000. They won in Ohio. They won the election in 2004, and they didn't know how to save it. They didn't know how to fight for it in the post-election period with all the shenanigans that were going on. So, you know, those of you who are true and tried Democrats, put some demands on your party here.
And with that, we'll move on to Roger in San Francisco.
Yes, thank you. It appears to me that both you, Ralph, and Matt are simply lost in egotism. You simply don't understand the political reality in this country. Now, because of your action in 2000 and Gore losing, we are in the Iraq War. You have cost this country closing in on $5 trillion.
I'm not going to let this. I am not going to let this political bigotry go on. This is this is political bigotry. Period. Let's get it over. This is exactly what they do in the racist area.
Wait, let me jump in here though, because I want to say something. Let's not forget that it was President Bill Clinton when he was being investigated for possibly giving perjury and that he was about to be impeached, started bombing Libya to get attention off of himself. Let's not, I mean, the caller asks us to engage in speculative history, and we don't know what would have happened if Al Gore had become the president. We don't know if 9/11 would have happened. We don't know if Hugo Chavez would have had an American invasion against him. We don't know what would have happened in Latin America, where there's a long tradition of American imperialism there. So I just think that there's a problem when somehow every problem that exists in the country is laid at the feet of somebody that ran for a political office in a democracy where the rules have been in place and well known for years and years and years.
He was actually bombing Iraq. He bombed Iraq many times, wagged the dog. The caller just doesn't understand that it was the voters who voted for Bush. It was the Bush team who stole the election from Gore. It was Bush who invaded in a violative constitutional sense Iraq. It was the Democrats who could have stopped him cold in the Congress, who supported the war resolution, which shifted the declaring of war authority from Congress to the White House. I mean, this is why I call it bigotry, Rachel. It is such a prejudiced assault on dissent.
Matt
has one vote. I have one vote. You got to ask yourself.
Is it so much an attack on dissent, or is it an attack on the timing and the approach of the dissent?
But Rachel, look, every single political contest I've ever been involved in or political decision I made, when people don't agree with you, they start calling you an egotist. Oh, I wanted to run for district attorney because I opposed the death penalty in 99. I was an egotist. I thought I could be the president of the Board of Supervisors. I was an egotist. I wanted to run for mayor. I was an egotist. I decided to retire from politics after serving a full term. Oh, I'm an egotist. Don't you see that the caller isn't engaging us or on that issue? It's a name-calling type thing, and I think it's inappropriate.
He's engaging in desired censorship. You see, he doesn't want to engage issues. He wants to say, you shouldn't have run. You know, just like all the people in the past who've told people, you shouldn't run, you shouldn't act, you shouldn't talk, you shouldn't print that, you shouldn't vote because you're the wrong color. Get over it. How many times have you demanded the Democrats to initiate impeachment proceedings against Bush? How many times have you demanded the Democrats clean up the electoral process? How many times have you demanded more of your party instead of making excuses for your party and letting your party scapegoat the Green or other small parties and not face up to its decay as a political party?
I wonder, Ralph, if when Eugene Debs was arguing that women should have the right to vote and he was getting less than 5% of the vote, if he was an egotist, or if James Burney ran with the Liberty Party and was saying that he opposed slavery and couldn't get 1% of the vote, I wonder if he was an egotist.
All right, we're putting out the call to Eugene Debs scholars. Call us, and for that matter, to the public with any comments or questions. Call us at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. And with that, I want to go to Chuck.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I think most politicians have tremendous egos. That's probably one of the main reasons they're in that line of work. I guess
is that are you insulting me? Ralph's never been in office, so that must be common for me.
I think you're still a politician if you're running for office.
That's
even
right.
If you don't
That's
win
right.
the election. But I don't have problems people voting for you guys if they do so. If their desire to vote for you guys is greater than their desire not to see some other guy win. but you guys have, I think, correctly said that it's important that you get past this and really start engaging the issues. And In the interest of doing that, I went to your website and looked under the issues section, and I got to say, it is incredibly minimal. And if you're really interested in engaging the issues, I have to say this, your website would tend to kind of makes me wonder how sincere you are about that, because
well, let's get a response from Mr. Nader, Mr. Gonzalez.
We've just gotten underway. By the time a few weeks come by, you'll see a lot more. On VoteNader.org, which is now off the VoteNader.org in 04, we had massive amounts of policy papers, details, evidence on 50 issues. So just bear with us a bit. We've just gotten underway, and we're sketching these issues. We have enormous backup for them, and you're good to want to immerse yourself in them. I appreciate that.
Well, let me put this to actually both gentlemen. So we get to November, mid-November, post-election, at the end of this year. How are you going to maintain the momentum on all of the issues you've raised?
Well, I can't speak for Ralph. I can certainly say that, I'm going to engage voters by just talking rationally with them about the issues. If somebody wants to vote for another candidate, I respect that. If somebody's fearful of what happens if they cast a vote for us, listen, I respect that. But I also have come to the conclusion that change isn't going to happen unless the parties see that people will make a choice outside of those two-party options, because that's what it's going to take. And it's curious, if you think about it, that's all that really should happen in a democracy. People run, they lay out the issues, they try to win votes. And as I said before, I invite Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, Senator McCain, anybody to win over the voters on any of the issues that we raise.
Beyond November, as you said, Rachel, we hope to form Congress watchdogs in congressional districts. We're asking people now to send in their desire to be part of these Congress watchdogs. I think 1,000 people in each congressional district, organized around 10 major redirections in our country, involving things like single-payer health insurance and solar energy instead of nuclear power, to let us know that, because there isn't enough of an organization of citizens monitoring these members of Congress back where these members really have to take heed in their hometowns and back where their votes come from.
Ralph Nader, you've talked about this being a tugboat campaign, and I want you to sort of get into that specifically and talk about where you think you might be able to push or pull Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama to move on specific issues.
I think corporate crime, getting much tougher legislatively in terms of prosecutorial budgets in the Justice Department, because they can't deny that all the business papers have documented again and again this looting and draining and stealing and lying that has been reflective of many of the largest financial firms and Enron and WorldCom and all the rest. The second is clearly to get them to pay attention to a serious peace effort on the Israeli-Palestinian front, because they know that this is so critical to our national security as well as the situation in the Middle East. And the third is to pick up on all these reports inside and outside the Pentagon, a horrendous waste of the Pentagon budget that is now one half of the federal government's operating budget and is draining tax dollars from being put back into the repair and upgrading of public works, schools, clinics, highways, bridges, public transit, sewage treatment systems, drinking water purification systems back home.
You've got a Republican front runner who, compared to previous campaigns or election seasons, is a little bit more center than the candidates in the past. Can you foresee a situation where McCain might come to see things your way?
Well, he is good on auto safety. He's good on climate change. He's pretty good, maybe even better than Clinton and Obama on contractual fraud in the Pentagon. He single-handedly took on Boeing's $19 billion tanker leasing boondoggle. He is awful, I think, on foreign military policy. I've called him the candidate of permanent war and intervention. But I don't see him coming close to winning if the Democrats really stand tall. This is a Democrat year, and this is a year they're going to gain in the Senate, and they're going to gain in the House. And 70% of the people are against the war.
Ralph, let me jump in because they can only make those gains, though, if they shore up clear principles on where they stand on issues like the war. And it's the ambiguity. And, you know, we can't have a repeat of the Nancy Pelosi victory where, you know, we're going to be told one thing, and then a year and a half later or over a year later, we're still sitting around wondering why all the Democrats are voting for war appropriations.
It's theirs to lose, let's put it that way.
Where do you guys go after this? What's your first stop on the campaign trail after form?
Well, I'm going to get back on a plane to San Francisco, but I'll be in Texas next week. And, you know, I think it's the strength and size of the campaign is dependent on you know, the support we have and what people want. But, you know, I think our responsibility is to do what we can to get the issues out there and to talk about them intelligently and responsibly.
I'll be heading up the East Coast toward New England.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking with independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader and his running mate just announced yesterday, San Francisco's Matt Gonzalez, a former Board of Supervisors president and mayoral candidate. Thank you, gentlemen, again.
Thank you,
Thank
Rachel.
You, Rachel. Very good questions.
My pleasure. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Tina Lorberg, Nick Vindinsky, and Inge-Lisa Schrobsdorf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive editor is Raul Ramirez. Michael Krasny will be back on Monday. I'm Rachel Myra. Thank you for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.